the other hand, the population that's on the ground suffering, they're saying, no, we don't want help to go through government because we don't want them to take the aid and do whatever they want with it, give it to their own people. We want the organizations that are helping to come and give us the aid directly. That's one thing. And the second observation
was that— We have 20 seconds,
Stefan. Yes, and contrast to 2010, there has been little international presence. Haitians have really been getting help from other local organizations. It's mostly been a thing where brothers and sisters are helping each other so far. So the focus needs to be put on the outskirts of the South Department.
Stefan Vincent, I want to thank you so much for being with us, a Haitian citizen journalist helping to cover the Haiti earthquake for the BBC. We'll link to your piece, The Forgotten Villages Cut Off from Help. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
La ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous traîne, nous entraîne, écrasé
notre... You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara LaMorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from 10 to 11 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm under schedule.
Hi, I'm Andrew Geller, host of Unbroken Chain, Music of the Grateful Dead and Friends, noon to 2, the third Saturday of every month. Throughout August, we're bringing you special episodes of our program to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the show. And KBOO is raising money for a new Studio Transmitter Link, or STL, to bring sound to listeners. Tune in Saturdays, noon to 2, and text GDAF to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/grateful to contribute to this one-time campaign. Thank you for your support for Grateful Dead and Friends and KBOO Community Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's outdoor mask mandate goes into effect Friday. A federal judge presses Portland officials on police reform. And in international news, President Biden ignores calls to extend troop withdrawal deadline. Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 25th, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Oregon's new mask mandate goes into effect this Friday. The governor's order requires all people 5 and older to wear masks outdoors in public settings where physical distancing isn't possible. Exceptions will be made for those who are eating and drinking, participating in sports and performances, or homeless. The order comes amid a COVID surge in Oregon. Daily infection rates are 18 times higher than they were early last month. Over 1,000 people are currently hospitalized with the disease. Infection rates in Southwest Oregon are growing faster than in any other part of the country. At Asante Three Rivers Medical Center in Grants Pass, 91% of its hospitalized COVID-19 patients are unvaccinated. The rise in cases has left them unable to treat other life-threatening emergencies. The CDC says unvaccinated people are 29 times more likely to be hospitalized by COVID, but the Delta variant is also spreading easily between the vaccinated. Federal District Judge Michael Simon urged the city of Portland to find a court-appointed monitor to oversee police reforms. 9 years ago, the federal government brought a civil case against the Portland Police Bureau, but the case still lacks a monitor. A court monitor would have the power to enforce accountability on the police bureau. The 2012 settlement found that Portland police used excessive force during encounters with the mentally ill. Judge Simon made his suggestion ahead of next month's meeting between federal and city officials. Mediation begins next month to discuss the Justice Department's findings of inappropriate police force and management during the 2020 protests. In particular, the federal government found the Bureau's tactics against peaceful demonstrators to be unduly violent and poorly accounted for. Federal lawyers also noted that the Bureau failed to hold officers accountable for violating use of force policies. The Justice Department made 9 demands of the city, including mandatory body cameras, a civilian lead for police training, an external assessment of crowd control training, and accountability for supervisors of the recently disbanded rapid response team. Criticism of the PPB and Mayor Ted Wheeler's oversight continues to grow, especially in light of their defiant inaction during last weekend's political violence in deep northeast Portland. Portland saw an increase in right-wing violence last year, but it's not alone. A recent report shows that a pro-gun rally in Richmond, Virginia, catalyzed a surge in political violence across the country. Diane Bernard has more on the story.
Armed protests in the U.S. are 6 times more likely to turn violent as unarmed protests, according to a new report, and researchers say the growing number of these demonstrations pose a threat to democracy. The report examines more than 30,000 demonstrations across the country in the past 18 months, many in state capitals, says Justin Wagner with Everytown for Gun Safety, who led the research team. Rallies with folks who bear arms, especially in states like Virginia with open carry gun laws, have been on the rise since a January 2020 pro-gun rally in Richmond, he points out.
In the last 2 years or so, there's been an increasingly frequent refrain of right-wing militant groups, whether it's the Oath Keepers or 3%ers, Proud Boys, who are taking to demonstrations and using guns to intimidate. And we think that intimidation is really dangerous to our democracy.
Many protesters who bring guns to rallies say it's their constitutional right and that bringing firearms to public spaces can make people safer. However, the study found demonstrations involving at least one armed individual tend to be violent or destructive nearly 16% of the time. Wagner explains the majority of demonstrations that encourage guns have been driven by reactions to left-wing activism and by far-right mobilization. He notes armed rallies have become so common that the nation has seen more than 500 of them in just the last year and a half.
The peak of armed protests was the summer of 2020, and there was a secondary peak around the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Since then, the numbers have actually been on the rise. And in June, we see armed protests significantly on the rise compared to where they were earlier in the year.
The report finds the top states for numbers of armed demonstrations are Oregon, Texas, Washington State, and Pennsylvania, all of which allow open carry of firearms. Pennsylvania and Washington State allow open carry without a permit. For Virginia News Connection, I'm Diane Bernard. Find our 8 trust indicators to support accuracy and transparency online at publicnewsservice.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael only trusts his skepticism and experience.
After this week of cool weather, don't be fooled. The heat will come back. Might not rain again until October. Remember last September? COVID fooled us doing the rope-a-dope till we stopped masking and distancing, and those COVID had already fooled, their freedom to deny science and get sick overrides our freedom to be safe, are now filling the ICUs in Grants Pass, Roseburg, and Bend, and Governor Brown gets labeled a flip-flopper because so many Oregonians haven't gotten their shots. As the near apocalypse of Trump made us think things would be better under Biden, as Kurt Schrader and Joe Manchin only call themselves Democrats for fundraising purposes, like that cartoon where the rich have a pile of cookies, the worker and the middle class have one each, and the rich guy tells the middle class he wants to take your cookie, while the rich have the entire world. And still every election, I get fooled into thinking democracy means I have an actual choice. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Given the dangers of leaving Afghanistan, European leaders had hoped President Biden would keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan beyond the announced August 31st deadline. In a video conference yesterday with the G7 nations, Biden refused. The Pentagon recently said that given the gathering speed of the evacuation, it was likely that all U.S. citizens would be airlifted out by the end of the week. Some British and German officials suggested that a civilian-operated airport could be opened inside Afghanistan, possibly by Turkey, for refugees fleeing the country. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said after the G7 meeting, quote, "When it comes to engaging with the governments in Afghanistan, whatever its exact composition, the G7 has huge leverage. $7 billion of Afghanistan's $9 billion national reserves are held by the Federal Reserve of New York, and the country depends on physical shipments of currency." Democratic senators in Kentucky are calling on the governor and Congress to open their state to Afghan refugees. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story.
State Democratic leaders are urging Governor Andy Beshear to offer a permanent home to Afghan refugees in Kentucky. At least a dozen other governors so far have pledged to help people leaving Afghanistan relocate to their states. State Representative Joni Jenkins of Shively says she and her colleagues have sent a formal letter to the governor and the congressional delegation asking them to implement actions to help fleeing Afghans. Jenkins notes many seeking asylum are at risk in their homeland because they served alongside American forces, or are women or members of the LGBTQ plus community.
Leader Morgan McGarvey and I thought it was necessary to act immediately. The legislature is not in session at this time, or we would have filed a resolution to be voted on by the entire General Assembly.
It's estimated around 88,000 individuals who worked for the U.S. in Afghanistan and their family members are seeking special immigrant visas. A recent survey of 1,100 U.S. adults found more than 40% would support increasing the number of visas for Afghans. 44% said the numbers should remain the same. Jenkins says groups like Kentucky Refugee Ministries and the Kentucky Council of Churches are standing by and ready to help.
Given the events that have happened in the last weeks and what all Kentuckians are watching unfold on the news, we thought it was important for us to communicate our support. We want to be part of the solution. We want to welcome folks.
The Biden administration has allocated $500 million for unexpected and urgent refugee and migration needs, victims of conflict, and others at risk as a result of the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. The Pentagon says it's using facilities in Texas, Virginia, and Wisconsin to house people applying for visas. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Last night, Congress passed the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which restores key provisions of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Most critical is the restoration of a provision of the 1965 law that requires places with a history of voting discrimination to be under federal supervision, which the Supreme Court had struck down 8 years ago. Congress had already approved the For the People Act, which would enact automatic voter registration, vote by mail, early access voting in every state, and an end of partisan gerrymandering. Neither bill is expected to pass the Senate unless the current filibuster rule is changed. President Biden has so far refused to take any action on the filibuster. With more details on this and other stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
People bled, some people died for the right to vote.
Alabama Congresswoman Terry Sewell on Tuesday hailed the House passage of the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. The measure increases the federal government's power to challenge or block questionable election laws.
If it wasn't for federal oversight, we not only would not have gotten the Voting Rights Act, we wouldn't have gotten the Civil Rights Act.
Louisiana Republican Mike Johnson argued the bill is overreach and unnecessary.
The cry of voter suppression is not only untrue, but is also divisive and dangerous.
Senate passage appears slim. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski is the only Republican expected to back the measure. Also on Tuesday, the House approved a budget resolution that clears the way for a massive $3.5 trillion spending package later this year. It requires the Senate pass bipartisan $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill to be taken up by the House by September 27th. Despite bipartisan calls to extend the deadline, President Joe Biden says he plans to meet his target of an August 31st withdrawal from Afghanistan. Biden noted that increasing risks need to be considered.
Every day we're on the ground is another day we know that ISIS-K is seeking to target the airport and attack both U.S. and allied forces and innocent civilians.
With U.S. forces scrambling to evacuate Americans and Afghan allies, the president noted military leaders are prepared to adjust the timeline if necessary. Meanwhile, a resolution backed by a dozen House GOP lawmakers calls for the Pentagon Inspector General to investigate the U.S. troop withdrawal, including how equipment landed in the hands of the Taliban. Texas Republican Tony Gonzalez served in Afghanistan. He said the Biden administration has given up the high ground on intelligence.
Right now is more dangerous to Americans than that first day that we went in 2001.
Several world leaders encouraged the U.S. to delay the final exit to ensure citizens of other countries could be evacuated safely. New York has its first female governor. Kathy Hochul was sworn in, replacing Andrew Cuomo, who stepped down after sexual harassment accusations.
I spoke with President Biden last night to talk about a number of issues. He pledged his full support to my administration in anything we need. Particularly, I thanked him for the support we've received from FEMA and others in terms of cleaning up after Henri and how we were prepared.
Hochul's first priorities include a mask mandate for schools and a COVID-19 vaccination requirement for all school staff. The FCC is proposing felony charges against two right-wing operatives over thousands of robocalls that discouraged absentee voting during the 2020 election. The FCC said Jacob Wohl and Jack Berkman would be fined more than $5 million for allegedly making 1,100-plus unlawful robocalls without prior written consent. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Wonderfill, a startup created by a Portland College student to reduce plastic waste that will be showcasing their fill station at the Alberta Market this weekend. At 6, it's The Underground. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partially cloudy with temperatures in the 60s. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with highs in the 70s and a slight chance of rain. Today, in 1991, Belarus gained independence from the Soviet Union. The quote of the day is from Belarusian journalist Svetlana Alexievich. "Freedom is not an instantaneous holiday as we once dreamed. It is a road, a long road. We know this now." Interim New York Governor Kathy Hochul acknowledged that her predecessor Andrew Cuomo undercounted the state's COVID deaths by nearly 12,000. Her administration's updated numbers bring that state's death toll to 55,395. Previous counts by the Cuomo administration were revealed in January to have excluded deaths that occurred in homes and hospices. The discrepancy in numbers was clear in differences between state and CDC tallies. Hochul announced that from now on, New York State will be using the CDC count in their official reports. Hochul took over from Cuomo almost 2 weeks ago after the former resigned due to fallout from a sexual harassment scandal. The police presence in Indiana schools is worrying members of the community. It has increased dramatically in the past few decades, but the benefits are unclear. Lily Bolke has more on the story.
As students across Indiana begin the new school year, some communities are reevaluating the need for police officers in schools. In recent decades, the percentage of schools across the nation with a police presence on campus increased from less than 1% to nearly 60%. Indiana doesn't disclose the numbers of police officers in schools, but in the last few years, between 900 and 1,200 students were arrested on school property. And Daryl Heller, who directs the Indiana University South Bend Civil Rights Heritage Center, points to data that show Black students are arrested at more than twice the rate of white students.
We know that Black and brown students will get punished harsher and more frequently for exactly the same behaviors that white students do. So that disparity is a deep cause of concern.
He adds this disparity often leads to criminalizing behaviors that are really just kids acting up. He's urging the South Bend School District to remove its 5 school resource officers. In Heller's view, a new agreement between the district and police department is long overdue and could be an opportunity to put resources to better use. Heller adds community members who want officers in schools may think it improves student safety, but research shows otherwise. He would like to see the current funding for school resource officers go instead towards more nurses and counselors on campus.
We're willing to spend millions of dollars a year to pay police to be in our schools when we could actually be using that money to pay for more social workers or more restorative justice practitioners or others who I think would make our environment in schools much safer than a mere police presence.
A bill in Congress, the Counseling Not Criminalization in Schools Act, would prohibit the use of federal funds for law enforcement officers in schools. Nationwide, more than 14 million students attend schools that have police officers on duty. This is Lily Bolke for Indiana News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
According to a new report, many New Mexico families have been left out of pandemic assistance programs due to language barriers. Roz Brown has more on the story.
Many New Mexicans seeking pandemic relief face an uphill battle due to language barriers, according to a new report. In addition to Latinos, language roadblocks apply to the state's Asian, Pacific Islander, and African immigrants and refugees. The report, entitled Eligible But Excluded, was compiled by New Mexico's Voices for Children. Research and policy analyst Derek Lynn says some federal relief programs have been administered by the state to offset harmful consequences of the pandemic, but they're not reaching all those who could benefit.
Many immigrants and refugees, because they speak languages other than English at home, have been unable to access a lot of these programs that they are eligible for.
Lynn says the new report is a follow-up to another one, Essential But Excluded, released last May. It focused on Latin American immigrants who have been left out of the federal stimulus payments. Conclusions in the report are drawn from in-person surveys and interviews with assistance from 3 immigrant and refugee serving organizations. Despite a requirement that state agencies receiving federal funds provide meaningful language access when a population totals at least 1,000, Lynn says many are not doing so and have not produced the required plans to make it happen.
People who may speak Swahili or Vietnamese, many of these languages that we have across our country that aren't necessarily supported in all of our government agencies.
Lynn says Voices for Children is preparing legislation for the 2022 session to address better language access. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Florida's Seminole Indian tribe have lived in the state since time immemorial, surviving attempts by the U.S. government to remove them. Now members of the tribe worry climate change could finally force them out. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the 1800s, the U.S. Army forcibly moved the majority of Florida Seminole Indians to Oklahoma, but a few hundred avoided capture and remained deep in the wetlands and wilderness of South Florida. Today, their descendants are federally recognized as the Seminole Tribe of Florida.
We're still known as the Unconquered Tribe because we never signed a treaty with the U.S. back then.
But 18-year-old Valhalla Frank worries climate change could finally push them out. She's concerned about increasingly dangerous storms and how sea level rise will affect Big Cypress Reservation, where she lived as a young child. She says salt water creeping inland from the ocean threatens wildlife and water supplies there. She says maintaining their communities and ceremonial grounds is very important to the tribe.
Because historically, that land there is where Seminoles originally survived.
Frank is one of 8 youth plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the state of Florida. The suit aims to hold the government accountable for its contribution to climate change and force the state to take action to limit future warming. She says it's time for the government to take steps to preserve her community's past and ensure its future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Connecticut's Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation is suing the state over what it considers inadequate compensation for losses sustained at its casinos during the COVID pandemic. With that story and more, it's Trip Krause with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Krause in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Connecticut State Superior Court ruled that the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation can recover only $2 million in COVID-19 business interruptions and cleanup costs under a $1.6 billion insurance all-risk coverage policy. The tribe had more than $76 million in business losses and cleaning expenses at its casino complex that it runs on tribal lands in eastern Connecticut. It filed litigation in January against Factory Mutual Insurance, seeking coverage and alleging bad faith and breach of contract. The court ruled that the insurance covered $1 million for communicable disease response and another $1 million for business interruption, but there was no more coverage available under the policy. On Tuesday, Navajo Nation held a virtual town hall to discuss updates on efforts to fight COVID-19. On Monday, the Food and Drug Administration approved Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. Dr. Laura Hammett is Director of Infectious Disease Programs at Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health.
I really hope that FDA approval of the COVID-19 vaccines will pave the way for people who have been on the fence to get vaccinated to take that step.
She says unvaccinated people are at high risk of becoming sick from COVID-19, particularly as cases rise and the Delta variant becomes more prevalent.
Delta variant has really changed the equation. This variant grows more quickly inside people's respiratory tracts, and it grows to levels that are 1,000 times higher than we were seeing with the earlier strains. And because of this, it spreads much more quickly and easily than the previous strains of the virus.
Hammett says that fully vaccinated people are well protected from disease from the Delta strain.
Widespread vaccination, continued use of masks in public spaces, social distancing, hand washing, and staying home when sick are really the only ways to control spread and to limit further mutation of the virus. Whether or not we get a hold of the pandemic is up to us, and we have the tools we need.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs announced the final updates to regulations to how it maintains titles to federal Indian trusts and restricted fee lands. One change includes the BIA's Land Title and Records Office will maintain electronic title documents. President Joe Biden approved an emergency declaration from the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe in the wake of Tropical Storm Henri. The authorization clears the way for the Federal Emergency Management Agency to coordinate all disaster relief efforts for the federally recognized tribe in what is now called Massachusetts. First a hurricane, then a tropical storm, then a depression, the slow-moving storm dumped large amounts of rain throughout the northwestern United States. Areas could receive as much as 5 to 10 inches of rain when it's all over. The Toledo, Ohio School District will rebrand its Indians mascot. The school board made the decision during a regular meeting on August 18th. In a Facebook post, the district wrote, quote, "We will start the process of becoming the Toledo Riverhawks right away." A tribe in northwest Michigan wants to change a school enrollment policy to allow only Native children to attend. The Little River Band of Ottawa Indian Tribal Council is considering a proposed resolution that would limit its enrollment policy for its next generational learning center. The Early Childhood Community Center includes children from infants up to 12 years of age. A tribal council meeting scheduled to discuss a resolution was limited to tribal members and tribal employees. Several tribes in Oklahoma will cancel their Labor Day events out of concerns over COVID-19 and the Delta variant. Some tribal offices have closed or returned to COVID-19 protocols, which include mask mandates and social distancing. The Cherokee Nation canceled some events and shifted others to a virtual format for the 69th annual Cherokee National Holiday. Cancellations include the intertribal powwow and softball and golfball tournaments. The Comanche Nation canceled its fair scheduled in September. Cheyenne and Arapaho Governor Reggie Wasani has restricted all powwows and social gatherings and funerals until at least September 22nd. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 25th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael. The producer is me, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Dan Raphael, Trip Krause, Anthony Lizowitz, Nadia Ramlagan, Roz Brown, Mary Sherman, Diane Bernard, and Lily Bolke. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO is Fortress on a Hill at 9, a talk show about the U.S. military.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Most of us in the Pacific Northwest are familiar with reusable water bottles by now. I've had mine for 5 years, and it feels like a real accomplishment, with different generations of stickers layered on top of each other as they fade away. Trading in other plastic containers, however, can be challenging. That's where a new startup called Wonderfill comes in. They're not the first to work on refillable systems for shampoo and conditioner, but they are trying to do it better and reduce consumers' plastic waste in the process. I spoke with Wonderfill's creators to learn more about their work ahead of the showcase of the project at the Alberta Market this weekend.
I am Amelia Eichel. Most people call me Mia. I am the CEO and co-founder of Wonderfill. I graduated from Lewis and Clark College in May 2020, and now I'm living in Santa Cruz with my co-founder, Shiloh.
I'm Shiloh Sachs. I'm co-founder and chief engineer of Wonderfill. I'm an electrical engineering student at UCSC, and I'm very passionate about sustainability.
To start out, what is Wonderfill?
So Wonderfill, I always tell people to think about water bottle refill stations, but for shampoo, conditioner, oil, vinegar, anything that comes in a single-use plastic bottle. So Wonderfill looks like a tap station, and you can go up with your reusable bottle and fill your bottle, and the Wonderfill refill stations calculate how many ounces you're dispensing as it dispenses. So for anyone who's refilled their bottles before, they know that usually you have to take the tare weight of your container, and that's unnecessary with Wonderfill. They're smart refill stations, and they are easy to install into any grocery store or university, because they're mobile and lightweight and they fit in a store shelf. So they are intended to be a very scalable solution to the plastic pollution problem and systematically root out single-use plastic from consumer packaged goods supply chains for all liquid and cream products.
Okay, cool. And so what was the inspiration for the startup?
Shiloh and I have been very passionate about sustainability for our whole lives, and I was doing a Map the System project while I was at Lewis and Clark. It's kind of a method for looking at a problem like climate change or the plastic pollution crisis and seeing who all of the different stakeholders are and really what the root of the problem is. And that's how I learned about the involvement of the oil and gas industry in the plastic industry, because of course, plastic is made from fossil fuels and plastic production is expected to really ramp up the next 20 years because ExxonMobil and Saudi Aramco and other oil and gas companies are kind of hedging against the possibility that demand for fossil fuels will increase in response to climate change by heavily investing into plastic production. So I became really passionate about the problem and kind of thought of the idea for refill stations while I was in college, and then had to put it on the back burner when COVID hit. And then that's when I reconnected with Shiloh. We've been friends for our whole lives, but she came over for a dinner for 4th of July, and we were talking about climate change and how concerned we were. And she was like, I'm an engineer. I could build those refill stations for you. So that's when it really kind of clicked that this could be a real thing. And we started talking about it every day. And fast forward to now, we're living together and working on this full time.
And the aesthetic choices for the inspiration of Wonderfill really wanted to give consumers that fun experience that, let's just say, most manual pump refill stations or even a water bottle refill or a gas station don't have, to give people just a motivation for reducing or completely eliminating single-use plastic from their everyday life in a fun way that is completely beneficial even if you didn't care about the environment.
So Wonderfill will be at the Alberta Market on August 28th and 29th. What can you tell us about that event?
So the Alberta Market is put on by our friends at We All Rise Consulting. They are an urban planning firm based in Portland who work on integrity and development. So a lot of environmental and social justice work. And the Alberta Market started last year with the intention to bring people into the community who had been pushed out by gentrification and give them a way to be vendors and sell their goods on Alberta Street, which is Portland's historically Black street and community. So this year they decided to focus on circular economy and smart city initiative, where the city of Portland is really interested in investing in technology that will help them kind of reduce waste and decrease their carbon footprint. So Quincy Brown, who is the main city planner at We All Rise, invited us to bring a Wonderfill up and kind of demonstrate our solution at the marketplace with the intention of showing people in Portland and Portland city government what our solution is and how it can be scaled.
So I'm interested to have you talk me through some of the planning and design process, like what products you've decided to target as part of this and where you envision installing Wonderfill stations. How did that come into being?
So we're really lucky because there is already kind of this ecosystem of refillable products out there. And our intention is just to improve that refill experience so that more stores and more consumers want to use it. So there are already brands out there that distribute their products in 5-gallon containers. So that was kind of Shiloh's, what she had to work with when building the Wonderfill. It had to have the capacity for these 5-gallon buckets that people are already distributing in. And then the intention is to have more brands who currently distribute in single-use plastic bottles switch over to those 5-gallon buckets because it helps with supply chain efficiency, it's cost cutting, distributing in bulk saves a lot of money and a lot of shipping costs.
Well, I'd say that one of the few problems with the 5-gallon model that some brands currently use is the only option to get that from a 5-gallon to the consumer's, let's just say, bottle or package is to manually pump it themselves, which is very time consuming, I would say very disability inaccessible, and just an all-around waste of people's time. We live in the 21st century, and it's just a very odd solution for a problem. And so we hope to fill that gap between the 5-gallon to the consumer's bottle in a very fast way.
Yeah, so the goal for the dispenser was for it to be really easy to use and accessible and quick. It kind of cuts refilling time in half to, you know, in a quarter to refill a bottle of shampoo.
So to fill a bottle, like a full, let's just say 16-ounce bottle of shampoo, it would take probably 3 to 5 seconds with our machine.
Yeah, so kind of cutting out all of the extra steps to make this as fun as possible to use.
You mentioned grocery stores and universities. Those are the main places you'd like to integrate them?
So we're starting with universities. I kind of knew when I started working on this in college that this was a problem that universities cared about because they were creating these zero waste goals. So Lewis and Clark had gotten rid of all single-use plastic bottles for beverages and cutlery and straws and things like that. And then the entire University of California system too had a zero waste goal. And so we reached out to the University of California, Santa Cruz, and asked them kind of what their strategy was for getting rid of single-use plastics on campus and meet such an ambitious goal. And they said that they didn't really have a plan for single-use plastic bottles used to sell shampoo, conditioner, condiments, and cleaning products. So that's kind of where we came in.
Yeah, the majority of the focus in the talk around reducing plastic has been, and rightfully to a degree so, around what we eat. So, you know, plastic bottles for Coca-Cola, plastic bottles for ketchup, for your soap. And there's, I think, a rightful thought there. However, the body care and things that we need every day just for basic hygiene have been completely ignored from that when it's a really easy way to reduce plastic waste.
So yeah, we're going after universities. That's been really exciting. There's, you know, a lot of groups are trying to advance sustainability in higher education. So we're going to spread our refill stations far and wide that way. And then in grocery stores, you know, we're intentionally making it so that it doesn't take up a lot of space and that it fits into a traditional store shelf. And we've gotten a lot of validation from the brands that we want to work with that that is something that grocery stores are interested in, yeah. But it just needs to fit right and it needs to work right. So we have a lot of helpful input from the brands that we're working with who have already tried to get refill stations in stores about what these need to look like and what the specs need to be in order for them to make it into grocery stores.
And is the end product going to be cost-cutting for consumers? Is that part of the thought process as well?
Yes, it is.
Exactly. So, for example, let's say you buy, like, I think the best example is like a travel size thing of shampoo. That's usually about $1.50. 75 cents of that is just plastic. And the cost just gets about, for a large, let's say like 16 ounce thing of shampoo, about 25% of that cost is just the packaging, not even including the labeling or branding, but just the plastic itself. So we are cutting that completely on the consumer end, as well as on the supply end. Just distributing in 5 gallons is a lot more efficient. So yes, we cost them less money to fill with the Wonderfill.
What are the brand stakeholders that are interested in doing reusable containers and refillables versus other brands that have, you know, stakes in keeping plastic and more branding like that? Is there a difference in the types of brands that are interested in collaborating?
We've actually been surprised to see that a lot of the brands that we're talking to, this is something that they've been wanting to do for a long time. And these are big brands like Nestle and Unilever, Seventh Generation, EO, the, you know, big cleaning and body care company brands. It just requires a lot of research and development, and the pressure to kind of invest in technology like this wasn't as strong as it has been in the past few years. So we're finding that due to, you know, a lot of the activism work that's been happening, where people go out and do brand audits and actually count plastic bottles that are polluting the environment and tie that back to the brand who made those plastic bottles, we're finding that those have been really effective and have actually resulted in most brands that distribute in single-use plastic bottles actively searching for refill technology like ours.
And we also offer brands benefits that wouldn't necessarily be involved with a typical plastic container. When you go to the grocery store to buy your, let's just say, container of conditioner, the brand is essentially guessing exactly how much product you want, but we're giving consumers exactly what they want volumetrically. It is a completely exact science, and we can give that information to brands. We can tell them exactly how much product people want, the product velocity, what's popular. There's a lot of data that can be given that plastic just can't give. So there's a lot of benefit to the brand that isn't exactly consumer-facing.
Yeah, we're finding a lot of the brands that we're talking to are both interested in reducing single-use plastic and just improving their supply chain and improving the way that they get product into customers' hands. And we provide a lot of those benefits in addition to reducing single-use plastics.
Very cool. Wow. So part of your mission is both to educate people on reducing plastic waste and to give them this new tool to tackle that. So what aspects of plastic pollution do you find are often misunderstood?
Oh, that's a great question. I think there is an entire side of plastic that people don't necessarily see as creating pollution, and that's plastic production. So plastic production is just as polluting as plastic disposal, right? We know that less than 9% of plastic has ever been recycled. And that's why you see plastic bottles and plastic pollution, you know, washing up on the shores of the Philippines and Malaysia and, you know, islands. But in addition to that, if you look at, say, in Louisiana, where a lot of these petrochemical plants are, the pollution from extracting the raw materials that make plastic, which is ethane gas, and refining it into petrochemicals is extremely polluting, right? The oil wells used pollute water and pollute the air. The refineries release really toxic chemicals into the environment, and that's just projected to increase. You know, the fossil fuel industry is investing heavily in petrochemical plants, and that's just extremely dangerous, and it causes cancer rates that are far higher than the national average in the communities that live around these refineries. So there are a lot of ways that plastic pollutes the environment that aren't talked about a lot.
And the microplastics, you know, plastic doesn't degrade in the way that, let's just say, a banana would or type of like natural receptacle would. Those microplastics never go away. They just get smaller. I mean, we're finding them in infants, in fetuses in the womb. Mm-hmm. They're found in all parts of the world now. And we basically did an experiment on the world in a mass way, but didn't really think about the externalities. And we're just ramping up. You know, there's no plan for after. It's just hopefully recycled, but recycling as we know it is not working. Yeah. And a lot of communities in other parts of the world then burn the plastic or burn the waste after it has been, you know, used, which creates another environmental impact and detriment. And it's just on all parts of this, it's unnecessary and horrible for the environment and public health.
Yeah, there are so many things to be said here. I mean, a part of the reason why we're reckoning with this problem right now and why it's showing up in the media so much is because in 2018, China stopped accepting our plastic waste. So all of the plastic that, you know, we thought was being recycled was really just being shipped to China. And now we have to kind of reckon with that and deal with all this plastic waste. And that's why there's kind of this renewed reckoning, and we have to really face the waste that we're producing.
And I think where Wonderful can come in, and there's been a lot of, I think, needed talk around recycling or upcycling plastic, using it for other things after it's had its first use. But to really reduce plastic, there just aren't market solutions for reduction. It's just kind of, I think, a little antithetical to our current system. And Wonderful can give that. There are very few technologies that truly reduce production of a, you know, finite material.
Yeah, reduce demand for it in kind of a systematic way.
I mean, plastic's great, you know, hard plastic, plastic's durable. It's an amazing material for specific, you know, long-lasting uses. But the idea that something we need just for a few minutes to be held in it is just kind of ridiculous. And I think people on some level understand that. And that's where this upcry is coming from.
Yeah.
Wonderful is a startup right now, but I'd love to talk about what the big picture would look like if refilling stations like yours were widely adopted. How would that look for people's day-to-day lives?
Good question. Thank you.